MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
Good afternoon, Dr. Ross Walker. How are you?
Fine, thank you, my friend. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you, mate. Not too bad. I got a couple of listener questions. Audrey wants to know about vitamins, in particular vitamin C. She says, how important, could you please ask Dr. Ross, when you next speak with him, how important is vitamin C in winter? And what was the other question? What else do we take vitamin C for? So Audrey wants to know, how important is vitamin C in winter? And what else do we take vitamin C for?
Two very good questions. Firstly, I think vitamin C is a good thing to take during winter. And equally, let me say, I think we should be getting most of our vitamins, minerals, trace minerals and trace metals, and what we call polyphenols, which are plant chemicals, from fruits and vegetables. So all of us should be having 2 or 3 pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables per day. And tragically, Brent, less than 10% of people do that. When you feel a cold coming on, especially, I think it's good to have some maintenance vitamin D. So I said vitamin C. So 1,000 milligrams twice a day during winter is just a good maintenance for your immune system. And it doesn't really work as an antioxidant. It actually stimulates different parts of the immune system to work better. But when you feel a cold coming on, a study out of Finland showed pushing that up to 6 grams a day has actually helped with reducing the severity and length of the cold. Excuse me, I'm just coughing just at the thought of having a cold. So I think it is important to have that for your immune system. Is it good for anything else? Well, I think the answer to that is yes. There's a fellow who was the only person in the history of the world to win 2 unshared Nobel Prizes, and you will probably know that's Linus Pauling, Professor Linus Pauling, and he had a theory many years ago that vitamin C was sort of the wonder drug. I don't think anything's a wonder drug, but he said that there's a thing called lipoprotein little a that you and I have spoken about for many years, which is the cause of 1 in 5 cases of heart disease. And he feels that taking a good dose of vitamin C prevents that lipoprotein little a from getting into the arteries. So I use it routinely in all my patients who have this elevated lipoprotein little a. So it's a good thing to take for your immune system. It's also a good thing to take for your blood vessels.
Now, you said 1,000 milligrams a day. What do you increase that?
Twice a day during winter.
Sorry, twice a day. So 1,000 milligrams twice a day during winter.
Maybe 1,000 milligrams for the rest of the time.
So what do you increase that to, that vitamin C to, if you feel a cold coming on?
6 grams a day.
So that's...
Which is six tablets a day. So 2-3 times a day. Noting that some people have very sensitive bowels and may get diarrhea from it.
Right.
There is some talk about kidney stones. I think that's nonsense. I think vitamin C actually helps prevent kidney stones. But some people believe that it actually makes kidney stones worse. So that's something people need to talk with their doctors about. Some people believe in it, some people don't. There's always varying opinions.
You just mentioned kidney stones. We were talking about that the other day, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And can I ask you a question? Is it true that you, if you drink more water each and every day, that wards off kidney stones, the creation of kidney stones?
No, not so much the creation. It just keeps the kidneys a bit flushed.
Right.
So if you have a history of kidney stones, the worst thing for you is to get dehydrated. So it's always important to keep your fluids up, but this nonsense about drinking 8 extra glasses of water a day on top of what you already drink, people who do that just spend half the day in the bathroom. So I don't think that's a great idea. And the point about kidney stones is that 90% of kidney stones are due to what we call hyperoxalaturia, which means you make too much oxalates and they precipitate in the kidney tract and you form stones. That's 90%. The other 10% are due to what we call pyruvate stones, which are infected stones. So people have a big infection in their renal tract somewhere, you can get stones from that. And there's also gout can do it occasionally. And there's rarer things like a thing called cystinuria can also do it as well. But mainly it's this hyperoxalaturia, so the calcium oxalate stones. And the best thing for that is to be hydrated. And there is a long-acting thiazide diuretic called chlorthalidone. And especially if my patient's got a bit of hypertension, because many people who get kidney stones also have high blood pressure, I give them a half a chlorthalidone a day, checking their potassium, because sometimes it can deplete potassium, and that prevents oxalate precipitating in the kidney tract. So you go to Google, avoid all the foods that are high in oxalate, like rhubarb, soft drinks, all of these things can markedly increase the oxalate, but you also think about taking this chlorthalidone, this thiazide diuretic, and also keep your fluid up, but don't go overboard with it.
Okay. Look, I'm going to hold this off until next week, but if we can come back to it next week, because I've got an email from a guy called Harry, and Harry wants you to go through, he said he has yearly blood tests, right? And Harry would like you to go through and tell us what you think should be included in those yearly blood tests, or in that referral, if you like, to the pathology, okay?
Sure. Well, I need to know what's been ordered and whether that's okay.
Okay, let's talk about a procedure that uses controlled electrical pulses to induce changes to the lining of the first part of the small intestine. It could allow patients with type 2 diabetes to stop taking insulin and maintain their glycemic control.
Yeah, a couple of studies have come out on this. One of 50 patients that was a sham controlled procedure. So imagine being the person who was in the study, but you didn't get any treatment. They just shoved a tube down your throat.
I know. I read that and I thought, wouldn't you be happy about that?
Yeah, no, I probably wouldn't be that happy about it. But it showed clearly with those people that there was an improvement in diabetic control. Then they looked specifically at this small group. It wasn't placebo controlled. 14 patients who had the endoscopic procedure, so you put off to sleep, pass the tube down your throat into the duodenum, send these electrical pulses into the duodenum, which is the first part of the small intestine, and it stimulates extra insulin being released from the pancreas. And what they found in these people, they put them onto a pretty rigid diet for the first 2 weeks after the procedure. They also used this semaglutide, which is the Ozempic, which people are now using for weight loss, but it's certainly a type 2 diabetic drug. And they found that in 12 out of the 14 cases, even 6 months after the procedure, these people still maintained very good control of their diabetes without needing to go onto insulin. So it may be that the treatment of the future is that either we do this endoscope on people once a year or maybe once every 2 years to keep their insulin being secreted well from their pancreas, or possibly even they might be able to develop certain electrical pulses that you can do outside the tummy, just on the abdomen on the front, over the area, and that might do the same thing. Who knows? But it's quite exciting stuff for the management of type 2 diabetics.
For people that are suffering from type 2 diabetes, what percentage of those people actually have to have daily insulin?
Yeah, it's a good question. You see, people say, I was before a non-insulin-dependent diabetic. Now I'm an insulin-dependent diabetic. Wrong, wrong, and more wrong. There's the type 1 diabetics, who are typically the little kids between 2 and 12, who develop diabetes where their pancreas fails completely, and they must be on insulin from the day they develop diabetes or the day they are diagnosed. There are other people who develop type 1 diabetes after that, and they tend to have other associations with it. But 90 to 95% of diabetes is type 2 diabetes that may become insulin requiring. But you don't switch over from being a non-insulin dependent diabetic to an insulin dependent diabetic. It's a different disease altogether that just still needs, you may at some stage need insulin. So the figures are somewhere between 10 to 20% of people will go on to need insulin once they've had a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. But that's typically 2, 3, 4, 5 years after the initial diagnosis, whereas with type 1 diabetes, you're on insulin straight away.
How far away are we from a non-invasive delivery of insulin for type 2 and type 1 diabetics?
Oh, we're getting closer all the time. In fact, they've been trialling things like intranasal insulin, because the nose is very rapidly absorbed across the nose. That's one way of doing it. Even some people have tried inhaled insulin. We're now, in fact, I think it was RMIT in Melbourne have developed this pill that's an oral pill that you swallow that delivers insulin, because insulin's a big protein, usually gets broken down in the gut. But this goes through the stomach, latches onto the small intestine, and almost delivers it across the small intestine, like a little tick or a parasite leeching onto the small intestine, delivering insulin. And you can take this pill maybe 2 or 3 times a day, so you're not injecting yourself. So all of these things are in the offing. And they're talking about stem cell therapy to regrow pancreatic cells, a lot of things in this space that are being developed. In fact, there is two labs in... in the one in the US in North Carolina and one in South Korea, where they basically had this little patch on the arm that measures your blood sugar level in real time and delivers insulin via the patch on your arm, so a skin patch into the capillaries under the skin. And it works the same as injecting yourself, and it also talks to your mobile phone. So maybe it will come to the time where the treatment of type 1 diabetes is just a patch on your arm every day.
For people that suffer, it can't come soon enough.
No, absolutely.
Now, this, we've got to say, is this study's been done in animals, not on humans, but there's a nano drug treatment for ovarian cancer that has led to an 80% survival rate in animals.
Yeah. Now, this will send the anti-vaxxers into overdrive because it's very similar technology to the RNA vaccines for Pfizer and Moderna, but doesn't have the same pro-inflammatory issues that some people say are there with the RNA vaccines. But it's the same type of technology. It's an RNA-based nano drug, which has this lipid coating in it, or a fatty coating in it, and it targets one of the major proteins that induces ovarian cancer. Now, ovarian cancer, as everyone will know, has a pretty dismal long-term survival. When the animals who were genetically primed to develop ovarian cancer were treated with this stuff, they had an 80% survival over a long period of time. So we're talking about the eighth most common cancer in women in the world. It's a dreadful cancer to get, so this is quite exciting. Once they start human trials, we may have a totally new therapy for ovarian cancer.
There's a story about napping. It's not as good for you as people may think, particularly if you nap for too long.
Yeah, look, I think a power nap in the afternoon is a good thing if it's less than 30 minutes. And this study out of Harvard has shown exactly that. 3,000 adults from the Mediterranean, because an afternoon nap or a siesta is a very common thing in the Mediterranean. And they found in the people who had an afternoon nap, if they slept for longer than 30 minutes, there was a much higher rate of obesity, high blood pressure, and other things that pointing towards cardiovascular disease, put up your cholesterol and increase your risk for diabetes. But if you have a nap for less than a half an hour a day, that's associated with much better blood pressure control and none of the other things I just mentioned.
Why is that?
I think probably the only argument I can use there, it wasn't a randomized controlled trial, but I think people who need to sleep longer probably have a predisposition to all of these other conditions. And for example, the almost ubiquitous in males and in postmenopausal females, sleep apnea means you get very tired during the day and have to have more of a sleep during the day. So the sleeps are much longer than a half an hour. And we know that sleep apnea is associated with all the things I mentioned: excess weight, high blood pressure, diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's more the reason why you need to sleep longer rather than the sleep itself that's causing the problem.
Right. Eating French fries and other fried foods has been linked to a higher risk of anxiety and depression. Ross, I would have thought that the regular consumption of French fries would make you feel better, not worse.
Well, can we give them their proper terminology, mate? They're not French fries, they're man salad.
They are, aren't they? Man salad.
Yes. So eating man salads occasionally is not going to hurt you at all. It's not a bad thing to do. But this particular study came out of a thing called the UK Biobank, and you and I have discussed many studies that have been sub-studies of this particular UK Biobank, where they've looked at about 500,000 people over many years and different parameters of their health and different genetic parameters and lifestyle habits, etc. This particular sub-study was just under 141,000 people followed for 11 years. And they looked at their intake of French fries or man salad, other fried foods, et cetera, et cetera. And they found that those who had the highest intake of especially French fries, as opposed to those who had the lowest intake, there was a 12% increased risk for anxiety and a 7% increased risk for depression in people who did this regularly. The frequent consumers were male, they were younger, and they were cigarette smokers. Now, the question is, why on earth would eating French fries cause you problems? Mm. Well, the answer is, when you fry potatoes, you release this dreadful toxic chemical called acrylamide, which is very pro-inflammatory. And so they found that even if you looked at the consumption of takeaway foods and a whole lot of other stuff, It was particularly the French fries that caused this rise in anxiety and depression. And I think through the fact that you're affecting this acrylamide.
So do you think that the depression, the anxiety, is a direct link with the inflammation?
Well, there's no doubt that with depression, there's a lot of pro-inflammatory stuff that's come with it. So we know that there is a link. When you look at, say, the markers of inflammation in the bloodstream, people who have higher markers for that tend to have higher rates of depression and anxiety.
Right. Interesting. Osteoarthritis. Look, there's 520 million people worldwide that have to deal with osteoarthritis, and there's new injectable cell therapy that could resolve this.
Yeah, this is really interesting stuff, because being a person who's had his knee replaced, and my osteoarthritis was just more traumatic, recurrent trauma to the knee playing too much sport. But a lot of people have osteoarthritis because of too much fat that's putting strain on their joints. But other people have it for more genetic reasons as well. So there are different types of osteoarthritis. But the reality is, as you say, a huge amount of people, 520 million people, have significant degrees of osteoarthritis, not rheumatoid, osteo, around the world. And so we've been looking for solutions. So there is no doubt that a knee replacement or a hip replacement is still the best treatment of osteoarthritis. There is no doubt about that. But wouldn't it be great if you could just inject something into the joint, and the synovium or the cartilage and everything else grow back because of that injection? Well, they've done it. So this is the Wake Forest Institute in the US, and published in Science Advances, and they found that a combination of these things called cartilage activated immune cells, and combining these things called progenitor cells, which is a form of stem cell therapy, markedly reduced synovial inflammation, cartilage degradation, reduced it, subchondral bone sclerosis, which is the bone just getting very, very thickened after you've had long-standing osteoarthritis, and also innervation of the pain sensory neurone. So it affected all of these parameters. So they've done a very small trial in 9 people with severe osteoarthritis, gave them a couple of injections into their joints, marked improved quality of life, much better function, much less pain. And then, and this is the key, because there is, of course, the placebo response, where you've had this treatment, you think, oh, well, I feel better now. But they looked at MRIs to show that there was proven regeneration of the synovium, which is that layer of cells that come off the cartilage that act as a cushion.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of inlegia.
But if anyone's listening, it's not available yet. They'll be trialling it, but hopefully in the next few years, this will be standard of therapy for osteoarthritis.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Ross. It's always a wonderful treat talking to you each and every Tuesday afternoon. We look forward to it next week. Already.
Look forward to it as well.
Already.
Thank you. Thanks,
mate. All right, mate. See you, Ross. Bye-bye.